You're listening to The Lyric Feature on RTE Lyric FM.
On this evening's Lyric Feature, the first of two programmes for Seachtain na Gaeilge in which bilingual writers discuss their work and their dual linguistic heritage. First up, poet Anne-Marie Ní Chóiríonn grew up in the Donegal Gaeltacht, and here she goes back to her native county to explore the folklore, history, landscape and language that inspire her poetry. This is Among the Heather Rocks.
So this path leads uphill to the cross and altar. My name's Anne-Marie Ní Chóiríonn. I'm a poet from northwest Donegal, and I've come back to the Gaeltacht, and I've come to Cruach na n-Éu, the Hill of the Saints, where I grew up and where so much of my imagination was informed and formed by the folklore, the magic, the language, and the beliefs attached to this bogland. As you can probably hear, the wind is very strong today, and to grow up here on Cruach na n-Éu was to be in a wrestle all the time with the weather. We get very wild rains here in Donegal. We also have these very dramatic views of the mountains and lakes and the sea. And I think that all of that experience has gone into my poetry. I found a quiet spot just below the cross here on the hill, and I'm sitting in the moss and heather, and I'm going to share a poem about my experience of growing up here as a teenager. The first time a tree called me by name, I was 13 and only spoke a weave of ordinary tongues. It started with a leaf, and next a mist came down from the hills, beating a lone skin drum. Scarlet pimpernels dropped hints that could not be ignored. No red is innocent. Badger trails called me aside for a word. Come underground, they said. See what we are made of. That's just one poem from so many poems that are informed by my experience of growing up in Cruach na n-Éu. This place gave me everything that has allowed me to write poetry. It's given me imagination, an ear for acoustics. It's given me a sensitivity for the natural world and for the history of place. And I've come back to the Donegal Gaeltacht to speak to friends, neighbours and locals who will help illuminate the world behind my poetry.
You're very welcome.
It's a gorgeous day, isn't it?
It's lovely. Come on in. First shot.
Wow.
The phone's your own shot.
Beautiful home you have.
Oh, good.
I've come to the Poison Glen, which is an enchanting place. Today there's a wisp of mist on top of Errigal, and the heathers are in their full autumn glory. I always feel embraced by this glen when I come here, and it gives me great comfort to know that the view I have here is not that dissimilar to the view my elders had. I'm at a table here in the home of Brian Lacey, who is a local historian and archaeologist. Can I begin by asking you how long you have lived here and what first drew you to the Poison Glen?
Well, I bought a house initially thinking about it as a holiday home. But once I came up and, you know, it's so beautiful and calm and peaceful here, that I just never went back. I just stayed here. So I've been here 6.5 years and as happy as Larry, why wouldn't I? An absolutely beautiful landscape on the edge of the National Park. Glenveagh is just there to our right. To our left is Errigal Mountain. And down below us are the two lakes. And on the other side of the lake, the magnificent Poison Glen. But of course, this is a Gaeltacht area. People around here speak Irish. And the name in Irish is Crow Niva, Crow Glen or something of that nature, and Niva, poison. But of course, Niva is very close to the Irish word Neva. And Neva is heavenly. Niva is poison. So is this the heavenly glen, Crow Niva? Or is it Cronniva, the Poison Glen? That debate goes on. And of course, it's both in a sense, because it's so stunningly beautiful that it is heavenly.
My first memories of the glen involve coming here with my dad, who had a milk truck. And we used to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and pack the truck with milk in the 80s. And we'd drive down here into the glen. And I remember the feeling of coming into somewhere that felt a little bit haunted, a little bit touched by the other world. It was a little bit scary, but also really, really exciting. And this place has a very special myth attached to it. So for somebody who doesn't know anything about the Poison Glen, might you tell us the story of this place?
The kind of fundamental myth of the area is this story about the evil god Balor. There was a little kingdom here in the early medieval period, I'm talking about the 6th, 7th, 8th centuries, called the Shilogda, the seed or even the sperm of the god Lu. And the Errigal Mountain just behind us here was the south pole of that little kingdom, and Tory Island off the north coast was the north pole. And out on Tory lived this evil god Balor, and he was evil, he was old, he was ugly, he was all these things. Whereas here at this end lived the god Lu. And Lu was the opposite. He was young, he was handsome, he was sexy, he was gorgeous, you know, all these things. But anyway, Balor is told that he's going to be killed by his grandson. And he has one daughter, Ethna. And he must ensure, therefore, that Ethna never gets pregnant. But of course, in the way of all things, she does. She slips up and she gets pregnant. And she gives birth to three children, triplets. Two are killed and one escapes, and he's the god, he's Lu. And Lu then comes to the mainland, and Balor out in Tory is furious that he's been tricked and his daughter has become pregnant. So he pursues the man who made her pregnant here to Donegal, kills him. And of course, that's Lu's father. So then when Lu grows up, Lu has to kill the man who killed his father. So he pursues him here to the valley. And Balor, the evil eye, he has one evil eye full of poison. And when Lu spears him, pierces the evil eye, outpours all the poison, and it, as it were, scoops out the Poison Glen. And that's the kind of the myth of the geography, the form of the place comes to exist. It's the kind of myth that's found in every culture in the world, or almost every culture in the world. You know, it's David and Goliath and Beauty and the Beast. All these kind of stories are all variations of it. But here it takes this particular form.
Why do you think it's important that we tell and retell these ancient stories? And what can myth do that an historical record can't?
I approach it from a sort of, I suppose, academic point of view, that these are ancient tales. But actually, whether I would want to see them preserved or not is almost irrelevant, because they are preserved. I mean, in the local culture, people would always tell you they met Balor, they met Lu. I mean, the place names, the names of the rocks, the names of the, you know, the hills, all reflect this. So this is part of ordinary, everyday common speech in this area. I developed a little sore on my forehead there a while ago, and everybody immediately said to me, "Oh, Banner with the evil eye, you've been living too long in that valley."
I had an incident recently where a builder came to the house and he wasn't being totally honest with me. And I was in such a temper, I found myself at the front door saying to him, "Balor's evil eyes upon you." I grew up speaking Irish as my first language, and I now write primarily in English, although I do write some theatre in the Irish language. But I really feel that my worldview in Irish has come over into the English, and that the English I write in is infused and ghosted by the Irish. And I wonder if you found that one language kind of seeps into another, or that different worldviews collide.
Well, I come from, of course, from the opposite direction. I was grew up in English, but always had an interest in Irish. And then I've come to live here in the Gaeltacht. But, I mean, one thing that I've become very conscious of since coming to live here is that Irish is a different register. It has a different approach to things. I mean, for instance, we recently had our same-sex marriage equality referendum. But, of course, in Irish, there wasn't a problem. There are no words in Irish for husband and wife. There's only man partner and woman partner, far caela, ban caela. So Irish is not just a different language. It's a different way of seeing the world.
I think it was very interesting to think about the Irish language in the context of the marriage equality referendum, because certainly in Irish, we're in relationship in a different way.
Yeah.
And you know, the word for family, chaula, it means everyone in your household. You know, which is a lovely way of thinking about family that goes over and beyond blood relationships.
Yeah. And interestingly, that's the word used in the Irish Constitution.
And to read the Irish and English version side by side, so often in the English version, the word used is man or men or father, but it's dinye. Person in the Irish. So the Irish version is much less sexist.
That's the sort of thing I think of. And it's a wonderful thing to have these two worldviews that we are heir to by growing up in this country.
I've just had a wonderful hour with Brian Lacey. And I'm walking down now into the Poison Glen. It's a still, calm day. And walking into the glen, I'm met here by a blushing rowan tree. It's the tree of protection and shielding. And there's the sound of birds, water. It's a bit like stepping back into a different time. I've come to the bridge, and sometimes when I'm standing here, I think of this bridge as a threshold or a thin place that marks the place of crossing out of one world into another. And I was here a few years ago on a full moon night, and I noticed a raven flying across the moon. And I remembered that there's an old raven lore or Fíoraíocht belief that says the raven can give you a prophecy, and depending on which way the raven is flying in the sky, can alert you to the future that is ahead. And I tried to meditate on what it is this raven might be telling me. It occurred to me that in our oldest stories, Aetna sometimes takes the form of a raven. And so there and then, here on this bridge, I decided that I was going to rewrite the Balor myth in a sequence of poems, but I was going to elevate the story of Aetna. And this poem that I'll read, it really looks to the experience of this imprisoned daughter, Aetna, who would give birth to Lu, the god of light. A villager speaks of Aetna. How many men did it take to drag the girl up into the island tower? Did she spit or kick? Did she try to bite through woolen binds, lifting clumps of skin hair blood beneath a fingernail? Did she struggle? Or was she simply led like a calf by Hazel Switch into a den? An island daughter bears the rage of pirates in her bones. An island daughter can empty tombs with a curse. Here in the aftermoon of all that followed, infants, marriage, loss, a badger lies wide open in the poison glen, red felishtram spilling out. It is written here among the heather rocks and electric eyes. She was not her father's animal. She was not her husband's prize. I'm sitting here under the watchful gaze of Muckish Mountain with local Banfasa Lucy Niehagen, who runs a project called Wild Awake. So the first thing I'm wondering is, how did you come to this part of Donegal? Because I know that you grew up in Belfast.
Yeah, as my first GMA. So like many people in the north, I suppose, coming to Donegal was a big part of my life. It's kind of reprieve from the violence of growing up in that area, whether it was explicit or under the surface, it was always felt. So coming here, my mother fell in love with Gorta Horka when I was very young. And I just always remember driving up from Belfast and just that moment of leaving Letrakannan and coming through the gap and seeing Muckish on the horizon and smelling the turf smoke, and like my whole body would just relax. I was just felt like, okay, yeah, I'm home. So about nearly 3 years ago now, we made the decision to move here and haven't looked back since, really.
And Lucy, you're a vital presence in our small rural Gaeltacht community, and you do this vital work in helping to reconnect people of all ages to a way of living that involves ritual, ceremony, ancestral skills, and all of those good things. What are some of the things that Wild Awake is offering at the moment?
So deer honouring, Omas Oish, happens twice a year around the area of Garten Loch. So exploring what it means to take the life of an animal, but also learning all the practical skills of how do we butcher deer, tan the skins, use the bones and antlers for tools, and see what ceremony emerges from that. I also have a longer program that I offer for adults, which is themed around, you know, how do we rewild in these times? What does that look like? What does that even mean? So, yeah, those are a couple of the things that I'm really excited about.
And when you talk about the taking of an animal's life, what does that involve?
So specifically, I'm speaking about deer in this instance. And do you know, since the eradication of the wolf in Ireland and the change of in the landscape here, the denuding of the landscape through colonisation, there is an overabundance of deer. And that has far-reaching impacts, not just for the land, the regrowth of trees, the regeneration of the land, but also for the deer themselves, that so many of the deer, you know, the older ones will grow old. They're not hunted. They're not killed by the wolf. So their teeth will wear down and they can't eat. And then because there's no trees, there's actually less food for the younger deer. So in that kind of, you know, what's sort of coldly named management of deer, I see it as a kind of wild service, as an ecological service, where the hunters go out onto the land. They know which deer to kill in order to contribute to the overall health of the herd and of the land. So we employ a hunter to go out and to kill a deer with a rifle, and then to bring the deer to us. you know, many of us do eat meat and it comes to us packaged in the supermarket, and we have such a disconnect from where our food comes from. So how is it that we can be active participants in this, actively choosing that, knowing what that choice means and what it looks like, and then feeling that great responsibility that comes with a life has been given, what will I do with this now?
We've stepped outside and we are here at the hawthorn tree and Skag Yell, having had a warming cup of hawthorn tea. My grandmother had lots of stories about the hawthorn and she really made me understand that it's a magical plant. But you're telling me that it's also got these health benefits.
So an incredible heart medicine for helping to prevent heart disease, for lowering cholesterol and blood pressure, but also for the emotional heart as well. And at this time of year, it's the berries that I'm foraging. So we can make things like fruit leathers and ketchups and jams and jellies and teas. And now with, you know, the arrival of the fire blight, so this disease that's affecting the hawthorn, like such an important time for us to remember like what our relationship is with them in order to protect them.
I'm looking around here at this abundant land. There is fern over here in this corner. There's Jora Jay, fuchsia up in this corner. It's like a treasure trove out here.
And just even, you know, on the grass here, we have Cuig Fádraic, the slán lus, the plantain. So incredible for like insect bites and small cuts and burns.
Maybe this is the ideal place to read a poem inspired by the land. Bog medicine. Drink these star-leafed nettles and keep in your purse a fern. To become invisible, say your harm to the hill. This hill is pagan. This hill is hill. It will answer in bog tongue and occasional fire, burning back the earth along the heather stream, despite bald heels of rock, despite the kissy mink, despite a saintly air, until the stream runs dark with what needs to blacken out of you. Lucy, I have to ask you about your wedding dress, because poetry for me is about so much more than words. And poetry is a way of thinking and feeling and intuiting and dreaming and making. And your wedding dress, which you handmade, is a kind of poem.
So now, I did not make the dress, but I tanned the skins for the dress. So this is 12 wild salmon skins.
So this is a kind of waistcoat.
This is the top. And then this is 11 reindeer skins. So I went up to my friend's tannery up in Norway. They work with local reindeer herders. So then myself and my friend Jessie went up and tanned the skins.
It feels so soft.
So soft.
Certainly it's the top of the tan. It's gorgeous. I bet the top of the tan. I can only imagine that there'd be the odd person who their mind is blown by the fact that there's a bride up there wearing salmon and eels. And
absolutely. In Rooney's nightclub.
I'm really interested in the subject of fosterage. Fostering has always been a part of my life. My parents fostered and still foster children, and I've had tens of foster siblings. I'll read a poem about that part of my early life. And in this poem, the names of my foster sisters have been changed, and I've given them the names of mythical figures and powerful women from Ireland's past. Sisters, let it be said, I cut a nick in my own skin, and by a spit became blooded to them all. Maeve swaddled in clean cloth like a gem, as her mother, aged 16, leaned against the kitchen counter and watched me hold. Breege and Marie, found in a trailer by the river, speaking in a twisted song. Emer, who was always going home. Neve, who I was wild for and who was wild for me, but who held me under in the pool until both of us were dragged out of the water sobbing. Dara, who pulled her shirt up to reveal a string of roses on her ribs. Here are the gifts of my father, she said. Grace, who could fix any error with a piece of purple gum. Sarah, pure as water, bold as fire. I can still see her tear across the hill on that guy's motorbike, high-headed and ready for battle. Tailed women, denim stealers, alley girls in white musk with nine lives. These were my sisters. We argued over top bunks. We bled on sheets. We were four in a room the winter the house was falling down. We wrote letters to the man on the radio. We scanned the news for names of the dead. We curled letters inside bottles and threw them out to sea. We snapped wishbones, swore on graves, buried our treasure. We swung the gold of our mothers over our palms three times and asked the air, will I be loved? Yes or no? Yes or no? Yes or no. A few years ago, I was invited as part of the Donegal Decade of Centenaries programme to write something about workhouse history in Donegal. And I really felt that I could bring some of my experience having grown up with children in care and having been a witness to families who are separated, that I could bring some of that feeling to a commission that looked at the workhouses. So I was really interested in the Stranoller workhouse because it morphed into the county home. Stranoller workhouse no longer exists. So to write this new work, I had to spend time at the Donegal County Archives Service. Hi, Neve.
Hi,
Anne-Marie. Is it okay to come in?
Of course, come on in. Just come through.
I'm here in the Donegal County Archives with Neve Brennan, and it's a bit of an Aladdin's cave in here. I'm surrounded by all of these boxes, records, folders, books, and really old handwritten documents. And there's that lovely papery smell when you walk into this building. It always excites me. So I wondered, Neve, if you would begin by telling us what is your role with the County Archives?
My job basically is to preserve the archives of the County of Donegal and to make them accessible to the public. And that's what I've been doing for many years now.
And so you have very kindly laid out a selection of materials here for us today. And this is exactly the types of materials that I was looking at a few years ago when I was writing about the Stranoller workhouse.
So we're looking here at an admission register from Letterkenny Workhouse. This particular register dates back to the 1870s and it's an admission and discharge register. So basically what it contains is a list of people who were admitted to the workhouse for reasons of poverty or homelessness at that time. So it's really interesting because often people poorer people are invisible in the 19th century records, particularly children. So for instance, here in this particular admission register, you see a family of Dohertys. There's Ellen and her six children.
Ellen Doherty, age 33, who is married and a housekeeper and Church of Ireland. She is described as healthy and her husband
her husband is in jail.
So, I see.
So this is what's the fascinating thing about the records of the day, is that it brings people to life in a way that other more dry records, such as the minutes of meetings, don't do. I have another document to show you here. This is a minute book from Stranraer Workhouse. And most importantly, that you see for around this period, 1845 to 1847, which this book covers, is there, if you like, the emphasis on the diet. So on page 10, you have a diet which is for able-bodied men and for women. It's also for the infirm and for children. And it, you can see, it has 8 ounces of oatmeal for breakfast, for instance. There's 4 pounds of potatoes for dinner. And for supper, there's more oatmeal. That's the men, and different rates for men and women. But then if you want to skip to page 266, which is the middle of 1846, the diet has been reduced completely. Mm. So here we have now the infamous Indian meal, which was deemed to be indigestible, but that was one of the main foods that was on offer. And then there was oatmeal, but there was less of it. By the end of the famine, by the 1850s, the diet has started to improve again.
It's heartbreaking to think about what people went through.
One of the basic rules, if you like, of workhouse life, or of the whole poor law, was that life inside the workhouse was not to be any easier than what would have been expected to be outside the workhouse.
I came to understand when I was here that predating the foster care system was a system of boarding out children.
Well, boarding out was a system whereby children, when they reached a certain age, they were taken in from the workhouse by maybe a farmer and his family. And it might be a boy or might be a girl who might be asked to work on that farm basically every day. They may have attended school, they may not have attended school as well, but really they were taken in as farm hands from a young age. It could be from any age, from 8, 9, 10 onwards. Life was tough for those children.
I got a very strong sense whilst here of just how harrowing that experience must have been for young children, separated from their families and taken away as workers at a very young age. This poem is titled Keen for a Boarded Out Child. What the archives do not record, the scent of rat, fat, tailed, scurrilous, and how it sickens a house the way it sickens my bones, to think of you cast out, baby-tongued, the wail of mama, not yet 5 winters new to your mouth. No one to snip your nails, no one to kiss your sore knee, no one to hold your hand as you made yourself good with strangers, to sleep in the outhouse, to swallow the slops, to become farmhand to the farmhand, in the barking rain, in the black petal rain. To cry was to loosen a devil out of a box, and all through the night, taunting, see that hook, I'll hang you from it like a piglet. I remember, Niamh, that threat at the end of the poem, that detail came out of some of the archives that were here. Yeah, I can't remember exactly where I found it, but I found it really shocking that one of the children had reported that threat was made to them. So I've just left behind Lifford. I'm back on the road and heading to the Crush Valley, Valcarra, where I'm going to be taking part in a very special event and catching up with an old friend, Paul Penrose. So we're here in Valcarra, which is my hometown, and it's awash with colour today, full of flags, and you can hear a marching band nearby. And it's Pride in Valcarra. It's our 3rd year ever of Pride being celebrated in the Irish language. And it's a really big moment for the queer community in the Northwest.
and also for the local community. So in just a few moments, the marching band is going to lead the group through Falkara Main Street. We'll do a kind of a route down the town and come back up again. So it's a short route, but it's lovely to be doing it surrounded here by the community and with the view, this gorgeous view of the hills, and such a clear day as well. There's no rain, so everything, all the stars are aligned for a really celebratory event. I'm here with Paul Penrose, who is a very old friend. Paul and I both grew up in Northwest Donegal, and Paul is also an actor with Ross na Rún and an activist and the founder director of Broad na Gaeilte, which is of course Ireland's first pride in the Irish language. And Paul, it's lovely to be sitting here with you, having done the parade earlier today up and down through Falkara town. It felt very special, very community orientated. What do you feel marks it out as different and special?
Well, a lot of the people that were there in that parade today, they're all people that haven't been able to celebrate pride through their language anywhere else in the country until now.
It's quite emotional to think about that, isn't it? Because we've always had to present our lives and think about our lives, you know, in the English language for other people. And certainly when I'm away from Donegal, and I'm, you know, I live in Dublin a lot of the time, I have to present myself and present my work, you know, in English. And it's so emotional to be back here and to be part of the community and to be chanting in the Gaelic language.
That's a important word they use, that you're presenting something. You know, I've been presenting myself for years here in my community in the Gaeltacht here in Donegal as something that I wasn't. And now I've certainly been open about my sexuality. For the last 3 years, I've been presenting myself with that very definite stance on who I am, my identity. And I'm presenting it in Gaelic.
And is that then the case for a lot of people, you think, over the last 3 years with this festival? It's a reclamation. This is who we are in our own language.
Exactly. And it's also, I think, a very unique and unusual way to bring the two things together, to be able to bring it into the context of a rural area that isn't an urban pride, that isn't an urban celebration of identity. And, you know, my very good friend Brian Lacey will always say that us queers have been around for a long, long time. In old Irish history, you know, you'll go right back to the 16th century and you'll find people saying, literally, scum a lum, which is, who cares, you know? And it's about reclaiming that attitude, bringing that attitude right into the centre of the community again, of reminding people that we have always been accepting, you know, and that scum a lum, you know.
So tell us about the chant that you were using today with the parade.
Well, I can't claim complete ownership on that one. I have to share it with another good friend of ours from the area, Sam O'Farrie. Another amazing poet, and he last year gave me that chant, and it's Vi te agus be gajo, and then you say back to me,
Era acha gela bio.
So it means we were, we are, and always will be queer, gay, and here or alive. Bio is life, you know.
It's got the beautiful musicality that doesn't quite translate into the English.
Exactly. You know, it wasn't written in English. It was written from an Irish language, from a Gaelic perspective, and it came out as Gaelic. You know, it didn't come out as English and then get translated into Irish.
Within this festival celebration of queer identity, rural identity, language, you know, where does poetry sit within all of that?
At the heart of it. Because just like we just said, you know, that's poetry. That's two lines of a poem, you know, and it came from a poet, and it's Bio in the community, you know. We just lit up the main street of Halkara with that chant over and over and over again, with the chanting of drums, you know, to give us that background and ground us and keep us literally in our landscape, in our grounding right here with our mountains and our sea and our air and our rain and our beautiful community coming out to see us. So the poetry of that in itself is fodder for poetry.
There's something really special about being able to be part of the parade, part of the march, where we're all moving to a drumbeat. And you're right, it is a kind of poetry. After the celebrations today, it's lovely to take a quiet moment and to come here to Cairnsport Pier, which is somewhere very dear to my heart. I used to come here as a teenager with a notebook and pen and sit here looking out at the water. And I used to imagine a life in poetry, what that might be like, with no real idea of what it might be like. So I spent many hours here sitting, just thinking about the unknown and looking into the unknown. And it's been a fantastic journey through the Donegal Gaeltacht, meeting people who have the most astonishing knowledge and relationship with the land. It's been really inspiring, uplifting. I've met so many people who have been able to illuminate the place that I come from in ways that not even I was prepared for. I'm going to close with a poem which celebrates life on the coast, and this poem repurposes some fishing folklore. My father was a fisherman at various times of the year, and so I was well aware of all of the superstitions attached to the boats and the fishing community. All throughout the poem, the word solace is used, and solace is the Gaelic word for light. And in this piece of writing, I wanted to gift an Irish language word as a protective shield. A blessing of the boats by the village mothers. Solace upon the hand, upon the wrist, upon the vein. On this day of sailing, we must honour the gods. Step with your right foot first into these boats that we have stitched for you from oxhide, hazel, sally rods and dirt. With this wren's feather, we bond you to light and ask that you let go old grudges against the barefoot sister, the red-haired sister, the sister who rises up fish-tailed between the rocks. Our motto is gather. A babe hears first of all through bone and water. The song of the mother before the mother becomes, the song of the mother she dreams to become. Take our dreaming as a torch. Solace upon the nose, upon the lips, upon the tongue, We rid your mouth of salt, of roses, of whistling. We good mouth your sailing. We set you off knowing what we know. Death is a mystery bell tolling at the water's end. Death is a cargo of gold on a sinking ship and a bird rising out of the wreck. Solace upon the temple, upon the brow, upon the eyelids of our loved ones who have been lost. We close their mouths with light. We light wrap their bones. We prepare for them a deathbed of willow hand woven. See how the willow bends and yields, how it folds, how it offers back, how it glows. Each blade a milk fruit, each blade a peace blade. Who can know how the wave will turn, or when the wave will bolt? In the language of the mothers, a thun is both a wave and the whole ocean. We keep the light for safe return.
Among the Heather Rocks was presented by Anne-Marie Nicaroyne. Anne-Marie Nicaroyne's poetry is published by Dira Press and the Gallery Press, and her pamphlet Ghost Girl was commissioned as part of the Donegal Decade of Centenaries programme. The opening track, Difference in Clouds, was composed by Michael Gallen and performed by the Prima Quartet, and Anne-Marie and Michael are part of the artistic team behind a multi-platform opera project, The Curing Line, by Irish music theatre company Straymaker, which will have its premiere at this year's Kilkenny Arts Festival. Among the Heather Rocks was produced by Claire Cunningham with sound supervision by Tin Pot Productions. The programme was a Rock Fringe production for the Lyric Feature and was supported by the RTE Independent Radio Productions Unit with funding from Cumasú na mBan from the television licence fee.